Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast tonight is about 72 degrees and clear. I mean, it is really awesome outside. This is where the past meets the future. In here, all the results are positive. Whether you're driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project while you're listening to an archive, we might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear, because you will be safely traveling with us. Lots of news tonight. By the way, I want to encourage you, if you have not already done so, to go back and listen to the archive. Last week we had Diana West, author of American Betrayal, on the program for the second time, and she was dynamite. Some of the stuff that we covered will change the way you look at history, that's for sure. We want you to be part of the program tonight. We do have live call-in lines free anywhere in North America. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. You can also reach us anywhere else on planet. 530-413-9537. 530-413-9537. I'll get those numbers out a few more times tonight. You can also participate in the program by joining our conference line, which is really cool, very high quality. It's 805-399-1000, 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769-608-POUND, 769-608-POUND. That will let you listen to the program on your cell phone, put it on speed dial, and then you can walk around and listen to the program at your leisure. The solar wind tonight is a frisky 393 kilometers per second. The proton count is up to 3.0 per cubic centimeter. That means you should wear sunscreen if you go out, even though it is September. There are five inconsequential sunspots on the sun today. The NOAA forecasters estimate a mere 10% chance of polar geomagnetic storms today and tomorrow. That's when a minor coronal mass ejection could deliver a glancing blow to Earth's magnetic field. Because the weeks around the equinoxes favor auroras, even a weak impact could spark a nice display. Arctic sky watchers, and we do have several that listen to this program, should be alert for northern lights. The September equinox occurred at 4:44 p.m. Eastern Time today. That's when the sun crosses the equator, heading south, like a lot of the migratory birds. And this marks the beginning of autumn in the northern hemisphere and spring in the southern hemisphere. You know, the equinox is near when you find yourself really having to go for those sunglasses when you're driving down east-west roads. The sun is right in your eyes. Earth, a new study has shown, could continue to host life for at least 1.75 billion more years. So your long-term investments will do just fine. As long as a nuclear holocaust, an errant asteroid, or some other disaster doesn't intervene. Hopefully none of that happens. Hopefully sanity will prevail. But even without such traumatic doomsday scenarios, astronomical forces will eventually render Earth uninhabitable. Somewhere between 1.75 billion and 3.25 billion years from now. That's a few generations away. Earth will travel out of the solar system's habitable zone and into the hot zone as we are ever moving closer to the sun, and the sun will continue to expand. These zones are defined by water, liquid water. If it's too hot, well, all the water evaporates. If it's too cold, We're just an ice planet like the planet Hoth. We don't want either one of those to happen. But researchers' main concern right now is the search for life on other planets, not predicting a timeline for the end of life on this one. Should give us plenty of time, I think. Hopefully, the discovery doesn't lead to a premature extinction event on this planet. Simple cells first appeared on Earth nearly about 4 billion years ago. We had insects 400 million years ago, dinosaurs 300 million years ago, and flowering plants 130 million years ago. Lead researcher Andrew Rushby of the University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom said in a statement, anatomically, modern humans have only been around for the last, 200,000 years or so. So as you can see, it takes a really, really long time for intelligent life to develop. That is, unless some kind of intervention takes place, a creation event or a seeding event. Rushby and his colleagues developed a new tool to help evaluate the amount of time available for the evolution of life on other planets, a model that predicts the time a planet would spend in its habitable zone. In the research published Wednesday of this last week in the journal Astrobiology, they applied the model to Earth and eight other planets currently in the habitable zone, including Mars. They calculated that Earth's habitable zone lifetime is as long as 7.79 billion years. Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. Meanwhile, the other planets had habitable zone lifetimes ranging from 1 billion to 54.72 billion years. He goes on to say, if we ever needed to move to another planet, Mars is probably our best bet. It's very close and will remain in the habitable zone until the end of the sun's lifetime, 6 billion years from now. But Mr. Rushby, doesn't that kind of mess with your model that, you know, we should wait for intelligent life to develop on its own on Mars? Or do you think we should relocate to Mars? You don't think that possibly others relocated to Earth and that's why we're here? Just interesting questions, one scientist to another. All right, let's cover some of the news of the day, actually news of the decade. There's a lot of talk out there about the crashing dollar. And as you know, this algorithm just fascinates me because of all the natural and artificial forces that are being applied to it and some historical data that we've seen where such has been done in the past. Bernanke, who you know as the Fed chairman, clearly stressed that the quantitative easing program, those of you not familiar with quantitative easing, that's a fancy word for printing money out of thin air and then introducing it at the very top levels of the financial markets. Anyway, the program was not on a preset course. In other words, it was ad hoc. Let's go ahead and print a whole bunch of money. Let's say, $85 billion worth. Let's see what that does this month. And lo and behold, it supported the dollar and the stock market began to climb. And they went, oh, gee, this works really good, really well. The no tapering, as you know, there was an announcement in the 2 weeks ago in the news, and it kind of made the mainstream news about 10 days ago, that quantitative easing would be tapered off. That is to say, the drug addiction would be withdrawn very slowly from the stock market to see if it could stand up on its own two legs. Well, it was a surprise to the market as bullion fell almost 20% this year in anticipation of a wind down in bond buying, but it has now gained from technical buying and short covering since the news. Short covering is where naked short traders or short traders are caught as gold did not go down as far as it was expected to, and so they had to deliver those stocks, which means they had to start buying, and that caused the price to jump a little bit. It's Let's see, gold right now is about 1357, 1360. It dropped just a little bit, it dropped all the way down to almost 1200 back all around the 18th of September. And since they said, no, we were just kidding, we're not going to taper off, we're going to continue printing $85 billion a month for the foreseeable future. And the 19th and 20th, gold came right back up again. And that's the story of how we manipulate our currency. That's just one aspect of the algorithm that's kind of fascinating. You remember Dr. Ron Paul, former Republican member of the U.S. Congress from Texas, discussed the Fed decision on Fox Business News segment After the Bell. David Asman and Ron Paul were talking back and forth, and I will just read the lines to you. David says, what do you think about the Fed's decision to continue money printing? And Ron Paul said, I think it's a very bad sign. I think it means the Fed is really worried. And David said, worried? About what? And Ron Paul said, about the economy. There are always bragging. They are always bragging that things are really well. Employment is up. The stock market is up. Everything is doing great. The seed of deception that they put out there is that things are really good. I think you and I know they're not. So now they are saying, no, now it isn't good, and we have to keep inflating. So I think it's a bad sign, but the markets liked it. So David said, the markets are doing well, but the average American's income is flat. Hardly, Mr. Asman. Plus, add in even the little bit of inflation that the Fed is willing to admit to, and frankly, it's more than that, because they are not including food and gas. Some food has gone up about 400%. Most food has gone up about 10 to 15%. Gas has gone up an easy 15 to 20%. Even then, they lose value as a result of their income being stagnant. So Ron Paul says, think about it in a moral sense, even if he gets his 2%. What right does the Fed have to take away 2% of their purchasing power automatically? What right do they have to punish the elderly who saved their money? I asked Bernanke and Greenspan the question, and they throw their hands up and say that they feel some people will benefit by this. And David said, what happens now? If it's Yellen, she'll be like Bernanke on steroids. What does that mean for our economy? Dr. Paul said, prepare for the destruction of the dollar and the crash of the bond market one day. The bond bubble is weakening, although the interest rates have doubled in the last year. David, the bond rates have fallen tremendously today, 16 basis points. That's about 2.69%. That's panic time, people. Dr. Paul, yes, but you wait and see. The trend will be zigzagging up and down. The prices are going up and standard of living is going down. The worst political problem we have is the discrepancy between the poor and the middle class and the wealthy. David, I feel I have to defend the Fed because the housing market has benefited from these low interest rates. Well, Dr. Paul says, yes, some places, yes, but I don't know if it's because of all good investments since they get the signal from the Fed, not their own savings. I hear adverts on the fly, and you can still renew your mortgages with nothing down. David, hearkening back to the financial crisis, Dr. Paul, yes. But as long as the interest rates are artificial, you get the malinvestment or the misdirected investment. But you don't know it's a problem until the crisis comes. David, what about Congress? Anyone there on it? Anyone following in your footsteps? Dr. Paul, sure, there are a few people in the house and my son. It's amazing. I was at a book signing last night and someone wanted to talk about the Fed. I said, how old are you? And the answer was 14. So money is a big issue. David, will it be a big issue in the next presidential election? Dr. Paul, yes, it will continue to be a subject. People recognize that the Fed doesn't give us nirvana or perfect economies, and it can't do much now to get us out of problems. David, will you run for office again? Big question, Dr. Paul. I will try to influence young people and energize the movement. Our campuses are alive and well. They are interested in free markets, liberty, and in the National Security Agency and our privacy. There is a lot to be optimistic about in the long run, but in the short run, we are going to have to go through some tough times, to be sure. Well, the other parts of the algorithm, and they're kind of complex. The bottom line, the main thrust of the bottom line is that people are not productive, and they want to be. People want to go back to work, but there aren't the kinds of jobs that they have been seeking. Although in some segments, incomes have gone up, wages have gone up. In other segments, they have stagnated. Even where the governments have stepped in and raised the minimum wage, this is just an unfunded mandate. All you're doing is telling businesses that they're not going to get any more work, any more productivity, but they must pay more for it. You know exactly what that's going to do. One of two things. They either have to raise their prices to maintain their margins and offset the cost of the additional labor. And it isn't just the minimum wage. You know, if you raise the guy from $7.50 to $10 an hour, who is an entry-level employee with no skills, then you must take the employee that has been there for a year, now has some skills making $10 an hour, and you must raise him to $12. And then the person that's been there for 3 years and can supervise, you have to raise him from 12 to 14. So you see, it isn't just the minimum wage that changes. It's the entire scale of hourly wages that change. Once that scale changes, it changes the entire labor dynamic for that business. They can't produce the same amount of goods for the same cost. Their cost of goods sold changes. When that changes, they have to make cuts in the amount of people that are doing the work, or they have to raise their prices. And if they raise their prices, they lose their customers because their competitors must raise prices at the same time. If they don't, then they're going to price themselves out of the market because you, the American consumer, are going to price shop. You're going to make your decision on which oil filter to buy, which gasoline to buy, which shirt to buy, tennis shoes, etc., based on price. And if someone has to raise their prices, Walmart, Target, Kohl's, any of those stores, you're going to shop somewhere else, and they're going to see it on the bottom line. So the only thing that you can do is cut heads. And sometimes you cut it at the counter level, which is where the customer meets the goods, or you cut it on the management level, where you just have managers working longer hours on the same salary. We call that Chinese overtime. And you see it happen in every segment, whether it's banking or real estate or whether it's manufacturing. Right now, we have the same level of manufacturing jobs that we did in 1968. That is not good because our population is much larger than it was in 1968. But we are not manufacturing things. We are just a service provider now. So when people come to this country, they can get served hamburgers, they can go to the movies, they can, you know, get their car washed or worked on, but actually manufacturing is way, way down. And that's down for several reasons. It's down because the financial industry has been literally on its rear end for the last 5 years and can't seem to get a foothold. That is to say, they want to take all their capital and keep it internally and invest it on money markets and securities, but they don't want to loan it out to their communities that need those loans to open new businesses and hire people. They're relying upon states and the federal government to take up the slack, and they simply can't do it. in case you haven't noticed, sequestration has cut back on a lot of services. And those of us that do business with the government are noticing it in the quality and frequency of the orders that they make. So how to get that ball rolling? How do you get the wheel to start turning again, the water wheel to dip down into the water and raise it up to an upper level and pour it into the trough so it will begin feeding the entire economy with that money? And make no mistake, there's a lot of money sitting out there. There's probably $4 to $5 trillion sitting on the sidelines inside the United States. Why isn't it working? Why isn't it doing what it's supposed to do in the community? Why is it not turning over? I'll tell you why. Because that money is looking for one of two things. Either they're looking for existing businesses that have been in business for a couple of years, have profitable P&Ls, or they're looking for non-risk investments, money markets, where they can make dozens of micro trades a week, making, oh, 0.1% or 0.2% per week. By the time you add that up, in a month's time, they've made 3-4% on their money. Doesn't sound like much until you take it on an annual basis. Now you're talking between 24 and 36% interest on money that isn't even theirs. It's their depositors' money. So now you see how complex the algorithm gets. How do you get that $4 to $5 trillion off the wall and into the dance? Well, you have to motivate them. You can't regulate them. It doesn't work. They'll just move their money out of the country. The only way to do it is to entice them with the ability to make a profit commensurate with the risk. The risk is there because the businesses in which they would be loaning or investing don't have track records. This is brand new business, brand new manufacturing. Lots and lots of great technology out there just waiting to go into manufacturing, but no money with which to do it. It is risky because many of those businesses, perhaps a majority of them, will fail. But some of them will be successful, wildly so, especially if they're timed correctly and they have good management behind them, which many of them do. So how do you entice that money off the wall and get it back in the dance? You have to do two things. And I've discussed this with, you know, media people. I think I spoke to Fred Barnes from Fox News. And I also spoke to William Bennett, the former Secretary of Education. And my suggestion was quick and it was succinct and it was targeted. Certain things that can be done. The first is you must eliminate the taxes that would be gained on those gains by investors if they invest in companies that, say, have a market cap of less than $100 million. In all senses of the word, less than $100 million is basically a small business in America. This is a business that would, you know, go into light manufacturing, you know, spare parts for lawnmowers or parts for electric vehicles or, you know, things like that. Lots and lots of things that could be manufactured. And there are thousands and thousands of buildings across the country that are empty and just begging for employees to come work in them. But in order to get the money in, attracted to those kinds of businesses, you have to make the risk worth the investment. And the way to do that is to eliminate the capital gains tax on that money. In other words, if a billionaire were to put, say, $100 million into a manufacturing company, and that manufacturing company in 5 years is worth $500 million, and that investor begins to sell off their stock 3 to 5 years, which is exactly what they would do, earning back their $100 million and maybe another $100 million, which is a nice return on investment. The idea is to not tax that second $100 million that they make. Then they would be willing to stick their money in that business, take the risk on that business, and wait 3 to 5 years for their return without having to share it with the federal government or the state government. Now, you say, gee, we would forego all that revenue. Well, you're already foregoing the revenue because those investments are not going to be made. And so you also lose all the payroll tax from the employees that work there. And everyone knows at least 15% of that payroll is going to be respent in the very community in which those people live, which means that the local communities and states would receive tax revenue somewhere around 15% of the payroll right there in that community. The corporate profits would eventually lead to additional corporate income taxes, which would be revenue that they don't have. It's non-existent. So you have to give that incentive to those investors to make that kind of profit, or those taxes never occur. Now, the second thing is just as important as the first. Yes, you have to allow the investors to make a tax-free income off of that, those capital investments into small market cap companies. But you also have to keep the short traders off of those small companies. And so you have to enforce the law. There's already a law in the books that makes this illegal, but it doesn't stop them from doing it if you don't enforce it. What happens is naked short traders go out there, take these public companies who have the ability to raise their own money, and they counterfeit shares onto the market. As you know, Tesla was targeted with this. About 40% of the shares that they had on the market were naked shorted. They didn't exist. They were called phantom shares. And the only way that companies can make that happen and make money off of it, and they do, is if that stock continues to go down. And of course, they spend a little bit of time and effort to issue negative press to make sure that's exactly what happens. If you'll remember back not long ago, Time Magazine reporter drove the Tesla Roadster, the sports car, the converted Lotus, and it ended up having to be towed out of traffic, and he wrote an excoriating article on the Tesla that it was a poor performer and he would never buy one. Long story short, the stock dropped about 10% in 24 hours. That was devastating to Tesla. And you could hear the nails going in the coffin of another green company, except that the folks down at Tesla had a black box in that car, and they recorded all the terrible things that this reporter had done to that car, driving it at high speed, driving it with the heat on, not charging it up for 3 or 4 days at a time. In fact, the information in the black box proved that the Tesla exceeded all of the design criteria, and that the driver, the Time Magazine reporter, had literally violated every single warning and practice and procedure in that owner's manual. And still, the car performed above and beyond its design capabilities. Well, when that article came out, the stock moved up about 25% in 4 to 5 days. When that happened, the naked short traders got caught. They had to buy the stock in order to deliver it. Because if the stock goes down, well, they never have to buy that stock. They never have to own it. In fact, they never even have to report the profits, because they never owned the stock. It gets taxed a completely different way. Well, having to buy that stock that doesn't exist, in other words, they couldn't borrow the stock, meant that the stock had to go up, because they were putting in buy orders and the sellers were holding out for more money. And so now the stock is somewhere around $180 a share, which is actually much, much higher than companies that are profitable. Tesla, as you know, has only had one profitable quarter in 14 years. So why in the world would their shares be about 165 times earnings? Well, because the naked short traders got caught. And now Tesla has roughly $2 billion in capital. They paid off their federal loans 9 years early, and they've done an excellent job with their press. So most of the companies don't survive that short trading cycle. They end up going out of business. And the short traders in the last 5.5 years have destroyed more than 3,000 American corporations that have started, raised their own money on the stock market, launched their businesses, and then were beaten down to mere pennies per share by the Naked Short Traders. Another one is Overstock.com. You want to read about all of that, you can. There's lots of stories about how Naked Short Traders have tried to destroy several companies out there. It was tried on Bank of America. Fortunately, Mr. Warren Buffett moved in, put $5 billion into Bank of America, and spanked the short traders severely. So it is out there. You know that George Soros literally broke the Bank of England doing exactly the same thing. So it is out there. But you must stop it by enforcing the law. And the easiest way to do that, not with fines, that's a bunch of garbage. That's just the cost of doing business to these guys. What you have to do is forbid them from trading. If they don't deliver all the shares that they sell or buy during that week or during that day, at the end of business day, if they fail to deliver, they cannot trade the next day. Once you take away their ability to earn money, you've really made a point. And that can be done. By the way, it is illegal in other countries and is enforced. But in the United States, it is not. It has not been for about 5.5 years. Now, I'll give you 3 guesses as to why that has been happening. Excuse me while I take a sip here and wet my throat. Ah, delicious. Okay. So those are 2 things that can happen. Take away the capital gains tax and enforce the naked short trading laws. Then small businesses can raise their money just like they're supposed to. Things will go on. They will hire people and they will go into business. Hired people earn wages. They're able to buy stuff and the cycle begins. And guess what? It has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with the federal government. They didn't invest one dime, no grants, no loans, no special interests, no lobbyists, no nothing. Just let American ingenuity drive the engine. That's what we're good at. All right. Some people have written in and want an update on Comet Ison. So there are a couple of good articles out there, although NASA does not know what's going on the left hand and right hand. Mike Wall, who is a senior writer for Space, this is what he has to say. And if you agree with it, that's fine. If you don't agree with it, please let me know. Our phone number here is 888-429-5471 in North America. It's free to call. And anywhere else on Earth, it is 530-413-9537. Mike says, we have nothing to fear from the incoming comet Ison. No matter how the icy object behaves during its much-anticipated close approach to the sun this November, scientists say. Comet Ison will miss Earth by many millions of miles during its swing through the inner solar system, and so will its bits and pieces if the comet happens to break apart along the way. One of the senior operators of NASA's famous Hubble Space Telescope says, during a breakup, comet fragments don't fly off in a different direction like shards in a cinematic explosion, like a Death Star coming apart. They break off but continue to travel along the path of their parent body. So any pieces would remain far from us a long, long way, and he's right. While a breakup would be bad news for sky watchers hoping for a great show from Ison, which was billed as a comet of the century candidate almost immediately after its discovery in September of 2012, it could have a silver lining. If a breakup happens, we may be fortunate enough to witness a beautiful string of pearls in the sky, similar to what Hubble observed when a comet SW3 broke up in 2006. Scientists think Comet Ison is making its first trip to the inner solar system from the Oort cloud, a repository of trillions of icy bodies, thought to lie, about 1 light year from the sun. Ison is streaking toward a solar encounter on November 28th, just after Thanksgiving, when the comet will skim just 700,000 miles above the sun's surface. They're called sun grazers for that reason. If Isan survives that close pass, and I, for one, do not think that it will, it's only a couple of kilometers across, it could blaze up incredibly brightly in Earth's night sky. Sky watchers and scientists alike are keeping a close eye on Isan, trying to predict just how it will behave over the coming months. Recent observations are not terribly encouraging, suggest that the comet is not brightening as much as expected or hoped on its trek toward the sun. Now, there is a NASA counterpoint. And you probably need to keep in mind that comets over the centuries and millennia in the past, when they are spotted by Earth observers, and keep in mind, most of them, as far as we know, did not have telescopes, so they relied on just, you know, without the light pollution that we have in our cities today, going out in the desert or up on a mountain or out on the lake or just outside on their back porch and seeing the comet approach. Usually in history, that has been associated with some terrible, terrible Earth events. And so, superstitiously maybe, there's a cause and effect. When there's a comet that shows up very brightly in the sky, it breaks up in a series of pearls, whatever, something bad is about to happen. And some of that is justified because comets are not asteroids. They don't, you know, stay on the same trail. As they start boiling off their mass, they change how they're affected by gravity, and these jets come off of the comet kind of like volcanoes, kind of like retro rockets. And so the comet is steered by this exploding or this slow explosion process, kind of like skyrockets pushing itself around. And so the path becomes quite unpredictable. So here's the NASA counterpoint. A comet's journey through the solar system is perilous and violent. Well, that is to say, for the comet itself. A giant ejection of solar material from the sun could rip off its tail. Before it reaches Mars at some 230 million miles away from the sun, the radiation of the sun begins to boil the water of the comet, the first step toward breaking apart. And keep in mind, these things are only a couple of kilometers across. They don't have a lot of gravity holding themselves together. It's just a big snowball. Sometimes it's frozen methane, frozen CO2, and can even be frozen water. And if it survives all this, the intense radiation and pressure as it flies apart near the surface of the sun, well, it could destroy it altogether. So it's a bad day for the comet when it comes close to the sun. Now, right now, Comet Isan is making that very journey. It began its trip from the Oort cloud region of our solar system and is now traveling almost on a collision course toward the sun. The comet will reach its closest approach to the sun on Thanksgiving Day. Again, just 700,000 miles or so above the sun's surface. We're 93 million miles from the sun. And if you stay too long outside, it is going to fry your skin. Pretty much anything on Earth that stays out in the sun very long will eventually be destroyed. If you don't believe me, just look at the dashboard of your car. If it comes around the sun without breaking up, in other words, it whips that elliptical orbit around the sun, the comet will be visible in the northern hemisphere with the naked eye. And from what we see now, Isan is predicted to be a particularly bright and beautiful comet. Its catalog name is C2012S1. Its common name, Isan, was first spotted 585 million miles away in September of last year. This is its first trip around the sun, which means it is still made of pristine matter from the earliest days of the solar system's formation. Its top layers have never been lost by a trip near the sun. Scientists will point as many ground-based observatories as they can and at least 15 space-based assets toward the comet, not the least of which are the cameras that we actually have sitting on the surface of Mars. You'll remember one of the rovers. We have Spirit and we have Opportunity. I believe Opportunity has long since died, but Spirit is still alive. And what they have done with that is they point the camera straight up instead of wasting the batteries driving around Mars. They just point the camera straight up into space, and that way we get a visual view of what's going on in our solar system from the surface of Mars, which is kind of cool. So even if the comet does not survive, tracking its journey will help scientists understand what the comet is made of, because they can spectrographically analyze it. Is it CO2? Is it methane? Is it water? What kind of elements are in it? We'll be able to see that as this vapor is destroyed in the sun's light. As it comes off, it will produce photons that are specific to the molecules that are inside that mixture. Closer to the sun, watching how the comet and its tail interact with the vast solar atmosphere can teach scientists more about the sun itself, which is pretty good. Now, it is not, it's not all there is. There is another comet. There's a comet called Comet Lovejoy. September 9th, 2013. That's just a few days ago. Noted comet discoverer Terry Lovejoy of Australia announced another new comet, bringing his total number of comet discoveries to 4. The newest comet Lovejoy will be in the same part of the sky as Comet Ison, beginning in November of this year, and it is going to make a very cool photo opportunity. The new comet has been formally labeled as C-2013-R1 Lovejoy. Terry Lovejoy apparently used a relatively small 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain. If you're not familiar with a Schmidt-Cassegrain reflecting telescope, it uses a mirror. It actually uses two mirrors. It is a compact telescope in the sense that it has a very long focal length, but the physical length of the telescope is short. It's very convenient. You can gather a tremendous amount of light with an 8-inch. They also make a 10, a 12, a 14, and a 16-inch. I can't fathom what a 16-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain would cost. But a 12-inch is a hefty machine. On a geo-tracking mount, you can keep the telescope pointed to the same point in space, and the mount will compensate for the rotation of Earth. If you've ever tried looking through a telescope, you set it up on a tripod, you know, get a planet in view, and then say, hey, come here and look at this. And they look in and, I don't see anything. Well, that's because the planet moves across the field of view so quickly that you need to have a mount that rotates with the planet on your particular latitude so that you can keep that planet in the center of view. And guys that discover comets put these on a special mount that tracks a certain spot exactly, no matter what the rotation of Earth is, and then they take a series of digital photographs, one after the other, after the other, after the other, and the computer stacks those photographs so that even though the telescope's gathering a lot of light, in a flash, it doesn't gather a whole lot. But over a 6 to 8 minute period, it gathers a tremendous amount of light. And if it's pointed to the same spot in space, but something is streaking across the screen, then that thing is moving at a pretty good speed. It's not sitting there like a planet or a star. And that's how it's done. So that's how you do this, and of course in Australia you get a view of the southern hemisphere, which we don't see in the northern hemisphere, and there's in essence it's pointing toward where comets would come from in the Oort cloud. So anyway, it's between the constellations Orion and Monoceros. Both Comet Ison and Comet Lovejoy are faint now, but both will get brighter. We're in September now. Give it 2 months. And with a good pair of binoculars, you should be able to see both of them. Unlike ISON, nobody is expecting Comet Lovejoy to become visible to the naked eye alone. You're going to have a pair of binoculars or a telescope. So why is everyone excited? Well, for sure, some will photograph the two comets together on the sky's dome, and that's going to be rare. So there will actually be three comets visible in the sky together in early November. Comet Encke, that's E-N-C-K-E, not Encke like Zachariah Sitchin's book, will be joining the crowd around them. So if you don't need a telescope, you don't have to have an expensive telescope, you can use a pair of binoculars, but you are going to have a swiveling office chair. And you're going to have to make a mount, which mounts to the arms of the office chair. You could make this out of PVC and some hose clamps. It's not that hard to do. Anyway, something that will hold the binoculars for you, because you cannot hold the binoculars still, for one thing. And even if you can hold them still, you can't hold them for very long above your head. And it's really nice to be able to sit in an old office chair with a binocular mount strapped to the arms of the chair, and that way you can sit there, hold a conversation, and you can stare for hours through the binoculars with no fatigue whatsoever. And it's pretty cool. So if you want plans on how to do that, write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I will be happy to send you some plans. You can go down and spend $12-15 at Lowe's. You can build a binocular bracket to go on your office chair. You can go down to Walmart or Target or just about any of the variety stores that have sporting goods or Dick's Sporting Goods or whatever, and you can buy a good pair of binoculars. I recommend 20 power, even though the field of view will be kind of small, but you can buy as little as 12 power, and you should be able to see these things just fine. All right. This part of the program is going to get kind of it's where the past meets the future, of course. We're going to talk about some history, and we're going to talk about how it relates to what we are doing now. It's what we like to do best here at X Squared Radio. As you know, anything put into the function of X squared comes out positive. Anything. You put negative 2, square it, you're going to get 4. Positive. Everything's positive. Except for one thing, and that's I. No, it's a small italics I. It's an imaginary number, okay? It's the square root of negative 1. We use it in mathematics to be able to manipulate numbers. We use it so that we get numbers other than 0 and infinity, and it helps us get out of the square root problem when we're trying to deal with negative numbers. So if you take the square root of I, or the square root of negative 1, and you square it, then you get negative 1. And that's how we kind of change the signs in mathematics. So that's why the number was developed, and that's why I am not the subject of X Squared Radio. I'm just the host. So here we go. I have a listener whose name is Eric, and he wrote me a question, and it piqued my curiosity. Hold on one moment while I take a sip. Eric must know about my affinity for time travel. One of my favorite subjects. I love all kinds of movies that deal with the subject intelligently. And he wrote me this question. What would you do if you woke up one day with the understanding that you were, somehow, in Germany in 1930? And for all practical purposes, you knew you were not going to return to this timeline. In other words, you are stuck there with the understanding that everything will unfold as it did back then unless you do something about it. What would you do? Well, first of all, Eric, I would like to say that if I were in that timeline, And knowing what I know now, any effect that I try to put into motion will change the timeline. So things will not unfold as they did back then. They will most certainly change. But for purposes of the experiment, I will say that I have an understanding that I am not on an alternative timeline. I am on a timeline in which Hitler is going to rise to power from 1930 to 1939, and he is going to be the scourge of Europe. And in 1941, the United States will go to war with him, and we will both lose hundreds of thousands of able-bodied men. And many other people will suffer because of it. So understanding that, I have had a little bit of a flash of this. You know, I was, I've relayed this story to you a couple of times, but I was in a Portland airport last year and I had a TSA experience. You know, if you fly a lot, you kind of get used to the routine. You come up to the first TSA agent and you prove you are who you say you are. You have a driver's license or a passport, and they scan and they look at you and they say, yeah, 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 that's you. And then you put your ID away and you go into a series of cattle chutes, lines, where you take off your shoes, your belt, empty your pockets, take your hat and your jacket off, take your computer out and put it into a dish tub, and all of your other personal belongings, liquids, things like that, that you're going to carry onto that plane and put it in another tub, and it's going to get examined with some kind of x-ray. You're going to go into a separate booth, hold your hands over your head, and with the exception of your private areas, it is going to be scanned, and you're going to be checked over from top to bottom. I heard a heavy person the other day say he was highly disappointed that the private areas were not, you know, more carefully examined, because he had actually not seen his private areas in a while, and he was kind of hoping for an HD image that, well, everything was okay down there. Anyway, while I was in line somewhere before taking off my shoes, there was a commotion. There was a woman ahead of me in the line further through the process, and I think she was about ready to get patted down for something she had around her neck or was wearing under her clothes. And all of a sudden, this woman, rather loudly above the din of, you know, people in the lines, shouted, "No, no, Osama bin Laden is dead, and you are all supposed to go home. This is over." And, of course, the TSA agent, in a fairly loud voice, said, "No, ma'am, we are continuing to keep you safe by, you know, examining everybody that gets on an airplane." And, you know, she was, again, rather loud and obnoxious. And actually, everybody in the line kind of froze for a moment, because we were watching this lady and we didn't know what was going to happen, if they were going to smack her over the head or tackle her or arrest her or something. And in that one moment, I just kind of looked up and I blinked noticeably. And for a fraction of a second, when I opened my eyes, everything was in black and white. And I got the feeling that I was in Nazi Germany. And these were lines of Jews that were putting their personal belongings into tubs as they were going through the line. And I realized at that moment how 8 TSA agents, unarmed TSA agents, could intimidate thousands upon thousands of passengers to open their personal belongings and put them in a tub and submit themselves to a body scan and a search, virtually volunteering to what has been for centuries an illegal search and seizure in our country. And I realized that through intimidation, how tens of thousands of people could be done the way they were done in Nazi Germany. So, Adolf Hitler and the Nazis waged a modern whirlwind campaign in 1930, as Eric has now placed me back in Germany in 1930, and it was unlike anything ever seen in Germany. In fact, I would like to say it was unlike anything anyone had ever seen in any country, maybe since Julius Caesar. And I'm just imagining the movies about Julius Caesar, how fantastic they were. Hitler traveled the country delivering dozens and dozens of major speeches, attending meetings, shaking hands, signing autographs, posing for pictures, and even kissing babies. Well, gee, that sounds, you know, like pretty common activities that a politician might make. But Joseph Goebbels brilliantly organized these thousands of meetings, torchlight parades, plastered posters everywhere, printed millions of special edition Nazi newspapers. Now, Germany, as you realize, this is 1930, right after the crash of the stock market in 1929 and after World War I, which left Germany in a horrible shape. Not only did they have the crap pounded out of them, but they had been saddled with reparations, which was basically a set of regulations and enforcement actions that were placed upon them by the Treaty of Versailles, making them repay an ungodly amount of money. In fact, I think Germany just finished paying the last of the reparations just a few years ago. And I think it was like 2 or 3 years ago. So Germany was in the grip of the Great Depression with the population suffering. And they were suffering. You've seen black and white films of this time where Germans would literally scrape garbage cans for just something to get by for a few hours. Inflation was so bad that it took a wheelbarrow of money to pay for a simple meal or a loaf of bread. It was unbelievable. The people were suffering from misery and uncertainty and increasing political instability. Now, for Hitler, the master speech maker, the long-awaited opportunity to let loose his talents on the German people had definitely arrived. He would find in this downtrodden people an audience very willing to listen. A people that had been broken, they had been demoralized, and they were being literally held hostage by the free world. So let me go ahead and take a quick break. I'll rest my voice for about 4 minutes, and we'll come right back. Don't go away, because we're going to take the rest of Eric's time travel challenge after this. So don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you.
Thank you. I've seen this room and I've walked this floor. I used to live alone before I knew you. Well, I've seen
Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. So glad you could be with us live here tonight, September 22nd, 2013. And if you're listening to the archives, I really, really appreciate you being a subscriber, because that's what helps us keep the lights on here. So don't forget to keep renewing that subscription. We appreciate you more than you know. And we appreciate Eric, who's one of those listeners, who's expressed his appreciation at the program, and that's what keeps me going for sure. I also want to let you know that the challenge is still out there to get a copy of Alienated Nation into the hands of your governor. There is still time to change and save the Republic by passing these amendments that need to be done. The only way it can be done is if the states step up to the plate and have a constitutional convention and make these things a reality, empower the Supreme Court and Congress to be able to seize control of the government away from the agencies, administrations, bureaus, and departments that now run and rule our country. All right, in the last hour we had a time travel challenge made to me, and that is that if I found myself in Germany, 1930, and I knew that things were going to unfold the way that history has shown them, what would I do? Well, we know that Germany was in the grip of the Great Depression, as well as being saddled with the reparations from the Treaty of Versailles. They were suffering from poverty, misery, and uncertainty, and certainly a condition of political instability. And it was a perfect, perfect field in which Hitler could run his ball. He would find in this downtrodden people a very willing audience. In his speeches, Hitler offered the Germans what they needed most, encouragement. He gave them heaps of vague promises while avoiding the details. He used simple catchphrases repeated over and over again. Wait a minute, that sounds pretty familiar. Oh, well, let's continue as though we're in 1930 and not 2013. His campaign appearances were carefully staged events. Audiences were always kept waiting, deliberately letting the tension increase, only to be broken by solemn processions of brown shirts with golden banners blaring military music, and finally the appearance of Hitler and shouts of Heil. The effect in a closed-in hall with theatrical-style lighting and decorations, all kinds of banners and rows of soldiers. Well, to say the least, it was overwhelming and very, very catching. Hitler began each speech in low, hesitating tones, gradually raising the pitch and volume of his voice, then exploding in a climax of frenzied indignation. He combined this with carefully rehearsed hand gestures for maximum effect. He skillfully played on the emotions of the audience, bringing the level of excitement higher and higher until the people wound up a wide-eyed, screaming, frenzied mass that surrendered to his will and looked upon him with pseudo-religious adoration. Wow. I'm sorry. I just had a flashback to the 2008 elections. All right. Hitler offered something to everyone. Work to the unemployed, prosperity to failed business people, profits to industry, expansion to the army, social harmony, and an end of class distinctions to idealistic young students, and restoration of German glory to those in despair. He promised to bring order amid chaos, a feeling of unity to all, and the chance to belong. He would make Germany strong again, end payment of war reparations to the Allies, tear up the Treaty of Versailles, stamp out corruption, keep down Marxism, and deal harshly with the bankers. He appealed to all classes of Germans. The name of the Nazi Party itself was deliberately all-inclusive, the National Socialist German Workers' Party. All of the Nazis, from Hitler down to the leader of the smallest city block, worked tirelessly, relentlessly, to pound their message into the minds of Germans. Every news outlet, newspapers, in those days very limited amounts of television, radio, movies, films, everything was dedicated to getting the message of the administration out there. On election day, September 14, 1930, well, the Nazis received 6,371,000 votes, over 18% of the total, and were thus entitled to 107 seats in the German Reichstag. It was a stunning victory for Hitler. Overnight, the Nazi Party went from the smallest to the second largest political party in Germany. It propelled Hitler to solid national and international prestige and aroused the curiosity of the world press. He was besieged with interview requests. Foreign journalists wanted to know, what did he mean, tear up the Treaty of Versailles and end war reparations, and that Germany wasn't responsible for the First World War? Gone was the Charlie Chaplin image of Hitler as the laughable fanatic behind the beer hall pushed. The beer hall revolutionary had been replaced by the skilled manipulator of the masses. On October 13th, barely a month later in 1930, dressed in their brown shirts, the elected Nazi deputies marched in unison into the Reichstag and took their seats. When the roll call was taken, each one shouted, "Present, Heil Hitler." They had no intention of cooperating with the democratic government, knowing it was to their advantage to let things get worse in Germany, thus increasing the appeal of Hitler to an ever more miserable people. Nazi stormtroopers dressed in civilian clothes celebrated their electoral victory by smashing the windows of Jewish shops, restaurants, and department stores, an indication of things to come. Now, for the floundering German democracy, the clock was ticking, and time was on Hitler's side. Along comes, in 1934, the Night of the Long Knives. We've talked about it before on this program, but I'm going to describe it for you now. Sometimes called Operation Hummingbird, or mistakenly sometimes in Germany, the Rumpusch. It was a purge that took place in Nazi Germany between June 30th and July 2nd. That's 3 days, 1934, when the Nazi regime carried out a series of political murders. Leading figures of the left-wing Strasserist regime carried out a series of political murders. Oh, I'm sorry. The left-wing Strasserist faction of the Nazi Party, along with its figurehead, Gregor Strasser, were murdered, as were prominent conservative anti-Nazis, such as former Chancellor Kurt von Schleicher and Gustav Ritter von Kahr, who had suppressed Hitler's beer hall push in 1923. Many of those killed were leaders of the Sturmabteilung, the parliamentary brown shirts. Adolf Hitler moved against the SA, which is the word that I just said, Sturmabteilung, and its leader Ernst Röhm, because he saw the independence of the SA and the penchant of its members for street violence as a direct threat to his newly gained political power. Hitler also wanted to conciliate leaders of the Reichswehr, the official German military, who feared and despised the SA, in particular Röhm's ambition to absorb the Reichswehr into the SA under Röhm's leadership. Now, this was all, you know, very complex politics, but the bottom line is that in 3 nights, 85 people died, although the final death toll may have been in the hundreds, and more than 1,000 perceived opponents were arrested. Most of the killings were carried out by the Schutzstaffe, also known as the SS, and the Gestapo, the regime's secret police. The purge strengthened and consolidated the support of the Reichswehr for Hitler. It also provided a legal grounding for the Nazi regime, as the German courts and cabinet quickly swept aside centuries of legal prohibition against extrajudicial killings to demonstrate their loyalty to the regime. The Night of the Long Knives was a turning point for the German government. It established Hitler as the supreme judge of the German people, as he put it in his July 13th, 1934 speech to the Reichstag, which, by the way, was about 10 days after this occurred, or about a month after this occurred. Before its execution, its planners sometimes referred to it as Hummingbird, the code word used to send the execution squads into action on the day of the purge. The code name for the operation appears to have been chosen arbitrarily. The phrase "Night of the Long Knives" in the German language predates the massacre itself and refers generally to the acts of vengeance. Germans still use the term Rumpusch to describe the murders, the term given to it by the Nazi regime, despite its unproven implication that their murders were necessary to prevent a coup, because some people had suspected that there was a coup d'etat coming and that they had to preempt this. Now, you have to realize that over the next 7 years, Hitler would do several things to come to and prove his power. The Night of the Long Knives was a devastating, sweeping bunch of murders. We don't do that anymore. What we do now is we just whip up scandals and we cause people to resign by digging up things in their past or leaking things to the press to take out our political enemies. That's just the way we do it now. We don't kill them. We just embarrass them out of office. So Eric has asked me what I would do if I found myself in these days. Obviously, you know, there are thoughts that cross my mind that, well, maybe knowing what I know now, I would find a way to assassinate Hitler. But that would not be so easy. And I'll tell you why. Because this is a guy that was paranoid about such things. He knew that if he used violence against others, violence would be used against him. I'm going to share with you, and you may not like this, but you know, this is where the past meets the future, and these are things that we do to try to bring this into perspective. This is a rare speech. It has only recently been remixed so that we can even hear the words in it because the recording was so bad. This was a 1933 speech to a German youth group. Now, we think of a youth group as, oh, gee, the Boy Scouts of America, maybe, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 scouts at a spring jamboree. Uh-uh. When you hear this and I read you the translation over the German speaking, you're going to hear how big this really was, how much it really meant to Germany, and how skillful and how familiar these words are. Here we go. This is Hitler's being introduced to the group. Here stands 65,000 Hitler youth. It's a sizable football stadium today.
Here stands 65,000 Hitler Jungen
from every part of the German Reich. 65,000 Hitler youth outside this arena, and there are another 1.5 million outside the arena. And at this hour, they are thinking of you and your great work. That's a million youth march by any stretch of the imagination. My German youth, just as we are gathered here, my young comrades, as part of the life of the people, so must also be gathered here the entire people. It was, alas, not always so. People did not want to understand each other. Each thought only of himself. At best, his class alone. We have been witnesses to the consequences of this aberration of the spirit. In your youth, you must safeguard what you possess, the great feeling of comradeship, of being part of the group. If you hold on to this, no power in the world will be able to take it from you. You will be one people, bound together as tightly as you are now. As German youth, our only hope is the courage and faith of our people. You, my youth, are indeed the living guarantee, the living future of Germany, not an empty idea or empty formalism, an insipid plan. No, you are the blood of our blood, flesh of our flesh, spirit of our spirit. You are the continuation of our people. May Germany live, and may her future, which lives in you, be praised. Germany. All right. Well, a lot of people don't like hearing that, but that is how skillful he was. And the words sound so familiar, so easy, so patriotic. So the secret to stopping a future from becoming the present is to listen to what is going on around you. Feel the resonance of the reality that is condensing from chaos. Some focused energy is organizing that reality. And if you do not want it to happen, you must manifest an interference that will not allow that energy to gain resonance. In Hitler's case, his power was not in his mind. It was not in his strategy or in his planning. No, his power was in his voice. His team was put together to make a media event out of every occasion. He was the master of the photo opportunity. He spoke to only his supporters. He never faced his enemies. He never debated them. He used his armies and drones to crush the spirit of his enemies. He used deception and greed and lust for power to bribe his generals and his killing teams. And when they would not be bribed or trusted to keep a secret, he had them killed. He would send them to the front lines and forbid anyone from defending them, where they would die. He would provide his political friends wealth and wine and gluttony, but he would rob from the rich and the producers of the country and give to the people who would fill the enemy's trenches with their bodies, just because he asked them to. No, the secret to stopping Hitler would not be to assassinate him. It would have been to stop his voice. In doing this, Europe would have remained free and tens of millions of lives would have been spared. As you know, in 1937, in April, he proved his blitzkrieg idea by moving in to help the fascist candidate in Spain to take out the Basque community of Guernica. He sent his blitzkrieg in and he dive-bombed that city. All civilians, block after block, street after street, for 2 days. And one night, Guernica was leveled. Franco came to power. The blitzkrieg was proven to work. A mechanized unit that could travel across a country in mere days. Country after country fell before him. And the West allowed it to happen because he was simply uniting the German-speaking peoples. We see the same thing occurring today. As the Islamic peoples are being united under one ideology, call it the Muslim Brotherhood, call it whatever you want, call it Al-Qaeda, call it Taliban, it doesn't matter. The Muslim nations are being united under one banner, one leadership, and the West lets it go on and on and on. What is going on in Somalia as we speak in a mall? What is going on in Pakistan against Christians? What is going on in India against peaceful believers there? What is going on in Syria? What is going on in Iran? What is going on in every one of 57 countries that you can call Islamic? It's happening. And the West is allowing it to happen because the voice is not being stopped. So what would I do, Eric, knowing what I know now? Well, anything as simple as a chronic case of laryngitis would have changed history forever. We're not doing that. What we're doing now is we are matching patriotism for patriotism. And patriots are the heart of war. Many non-Muslims feel threatened by the hateful teachings of the Quran, a Muslim holy book. For example, the Quran calls Jews the children of apes and pigs, and calls on Muslims not to befriend Jews or Christians. It demands that Muslims slay the idolaters, Buddhists, Hindus, followers of any religion not comporting with their view of Allah and Muhammad. It calls on Muslims to wage jihad, which is wars, against non-Muslims to collect war booty and to impose jizya, taxes on them as part of the imposition of Sharia, which is Muslim law, on the defeated non-Muslims. Jizya can be received in many forms, such as welfare or other forms of government handouts. The U.S. Constitution guarantees American residents, including non-citizens, complete religious freedom. This is a freedom to worship, not to spread hatred of our society, culture, and mores in the presumably religious settings and environments of mosques and Islamic centers. The indoctrination of Muslims, young and old, with hate-filled, violent ideas are a justifiable concern among non-Muslims. It is disconcerting for Christians, Jews, or any other non-Muslim to understand that local mosques and Islamic cultural centers are teaching these hateful values to their Muslim neighbors and their children. The recent rapes, tortures, and murders of Coptic Christians in Egypt and the continued barbaric savagery committed against Christians in Nigeria and across Africa should be very instructive. More than 100 million Africans, 160 million Christians, Buddhists, and Hindus have been killed by Islamic Jihad. Entire Jewish populations have been destroyed in Muslim countries. Non-Muslims have a right to demand that Muslims in America undertake serious reforms of Islam ideology. As Americans, we must demand these issues be addressed immediately. The entire Western world is outraged. We're offended and scandalized because the Egyptian army has dared to dislodge the Muslim Brotherhood from the two bastions of Rabia and Nada, where they have been barricaded for several weeks. The bottom line, more than 600 dead in the two camps. In no time at all, the right-thinking Western media uttered cries and whimpers asking the Security Council and an international human rights association to condemn this savage aggression with the utmost firmness. The poor Muslim brothers, victims of violence, those gentle lambs, well known for their sweetness and innocence, the object of unacceptable brutality. Consequently, it's a duty to defend them against the devouring wolves of the Egyptian army and police. The USA, Great Britain, France, Germany, Turkey, the UN, then should rise as one man to denounce injustice, defend those innocents, and invite the world to fly to their rescue. The international media instantly leapt upon Pegasus to charge at the guilty ones. This lifting of shields to claim and proclaim the right of all citizens to protest peacefully has something tragicomical about it. Let's just consider the facts, and there are many, but I'm only going to discuss eight here. Number one, the Rabah Mosque where the brothers were holed up was a real armory, where an incredible arsenal of war was discovered. No denunciations from the West. 2. For weeks, the brotherhoods, militias, armed to the teeth, sowed terror among the whole population of Egypt. Killings, abductions, kidnappings, rapes, random demands. Girls were forcibly married to Muslims. Again, no reaction from the West. 3. More than 20 police stations looted and burned. Nearly 50 policemen and officers killed and tortured in the most savage way. Again, silence from the West. 4. Sufi mausoleums destroyed and Shiite families massacred, raising no international emotion. 5. Some 50 churches, schools, Christian institutions burned in a single day of August 14th, just a month ago. Again, no protest on the part of the West. 6. Priests and Christians attacked and killed, including children of tender age, for the sole reason that they were Christians. No Western denunciation appeared, which might be accused of Islamophobia, which today is the crime of crimes. 7. Nearly 1,500 people massacred by Morsi militias during its one-year reign. Silence from the media. And finally, secret agreements from Morsi to sell Egypt piece by piece to its neighbors. 40% of the Sinai to Hamas and the Palestinians, Nubia to Omar al-Bashir, and the western portion of the territory to Libya. This is a gift for the West, since it was their doing. When Egypt finally decides to react and put some order in the house, then the West cries persecution, injustice, scandal. It is a secret to no one that the presidential elections were a broad farce and that the election was tainted by massive fraud. Nevertheless, the media persisted in asserting that Morsi was the first president in Egyptian history to be, quote, democratically elected, and that he achieved legitimacy. The Egyptian people are easy to blame, since they are agreed to play this game, saying to themselves, let's see what they actually do. The result was so catastrophic. Insecurity, unemployment, inflation, disease, bread and gasoline shortage, the economy in free fall, moribund tourism, absolutely devastating over 95% of the income to that country. And that at the end of 1 year, the entire population requested Morsi to get out. Within 2 months, the Tamarod movement collected more than 22 million signatures calling for his departure. In vain. Facing his obstinacy, tens of millions of Egyptians, the majority of which were the humble people who had been his former supporters, turned out on the streets of major cities to demand his departure. Still in vain. The army, neutral until then, decided to intervene to support the people and toss these bums out, keeping them under house arrest. During long hours of interrogation, the army got revelations of exceptional wrongdoings that comprised both the Muslim Brotherhood and a number of, you guessed it, foreign countries. Faced with the army's power grab, the West immediately cried, coup d'etat, coup d'etat. If it had been a coup d'etat, it was a people's coup rather than a military one. The army had merely acquiesced to the will of the people. The people were fed up with a president who had betrayed, flim-flammed, hoodwinked them, and they reacted with a survival reflex, calling for his departure. A delightful little story illustrates this very well. A guy buys a can of something at the grocery which once opened appears to be spoiled. What's he going to do? Eat it or toss it? Toss it, obviously. It's kind of what did the Egyptian people did after Morsi and the brothers promised the moon and the stars. Well, once the can was opened, they realized that it was all rotten, and so they reacted by tossing it out. Following Morsi's house arrest, the army still wanted to have the Muslim Brotherhood contribute to the new government, offering them to team up with other parties. That met with systematic and stubborn refusal. They didn't want a representative government. After numerous unsuccessful attempts of dialogue and negotiations with them, a new provisional government was set up for them. It was then they decided to go underground and sow terror. In this, they were highly successful. But this strategy has only increased their unpopularity. And we can say today that the Egyptian people despise and abhor them. Equipped with the most sophisticated weapons, the brothers are everywhere, burning, attacking, killing, and destroying. The army then decreed a state of emergency and imposed a curfew from sunset to sunrise. But the Muslim Brotherhood considered themselves exempt from compliance. August 16th, near Ramses Avenue and Ramses Square, there were explosions, single shots, and submachine gun fire from the surrounding streets. After several warnings to young people to go home, the army decided to send in tanks to enforce the curfew. Seeing the collateral damage, well-thinking Westerners indicted the army for having the nerve to attack peaceful demonstrators. Who are they trying to kid? Well, the real winner of all elections, you must know, is apathy. When we are young, we dream, we hope, we imagine the great things we will do and see. Somewhere in our teens, we learn that distractions are desirable, but not conducive to achieving our goals. As we become more and more goal-oriented, we learn to tune out those distractions like parties and sex and loafing, things like that. We learn to focus on our studies, our job growth, and perhaps even the development of our own technology to make a new empire for ourselves and our family. From time to time, we choose up teams and a captain. To be chosen is nice, as long as it fits our path to our own particular future plans. The line of candidates forms all the time in our various organizations. And then the leader is asked to please step forward. But most of the time, the entire line steps backward, leaving the straggler out in front. And guess what? He gets the job. For centuries, there are two types of men who rise to the leadership position. Those with the amorous lust for the position and all its pomp and wealth, and those who will do what they are told from commanders behind the curtains. Soldiers, they are called. Good soldiers. Like Susan Rice, good soldier. She did exactly what she was told to do from behind the curtains. And she exposed no one. The result? Promotion. They are all faithful and loyal, and they will not disobey their commander. They may serve as Secretary of State, flying all over the world, meeting with all kinds of people, making all kinds of promises, making all kinds of deals, and never disobeying their commander, even if they ran against them in the last election. even if during that election they hurled all manner of threats and exposures and name-calling. No, they're a good soldier. They are faithful and loyal, and they will not disobey their commander. Patriots, we call them. Individuals who will do whatever they are told with the innate belief that in doing so they are serving their country. They will pick up the sword and end the enemy of their commander, even if that enemy is their enemy, even if that enemy is their own neighbor. We are so frustrated with our leaders right now. We feel like we get the same thing election after election. It seems like their agenda never changed in more than 80 years. And the reality is that it has not. The commanders have a plan, and it relies upon our apathy and the lack of commitment of truly talented people to assume the role of leadership. So the point I would like to make here is that there is a complex algorithm here, and here are the inputs. The commander's agenda to take over the world using poverty and the crashing of the dollar. The middle leaders who lust for power and have mastered the process of propaganda to keep their sheeple asleep and confused while they build for themselves billions and castles and gold. And number three, the apathy of the masses, who do not want to be bothered with anything but their process of earning a paycheck. And sometimes that check comes from their labor, but most of the time today, over 64% comes from someone who is willing to pay them to do absolutely nothing but keep going to the mall. So I really don't know what to make of all this, except to tell you that we have an election coming up in about 1 year. Next Labor Day, the election begins in earnest. Every single member of Congress is up for election. We have an extreme, and a third of the Senate, by the way, we have an extremely opportune moment in time to seize control back from the agency government. We can elect a new Congress. They are all going to be fired. They're open to be fired in November of next year. We call it the midterm election, but every 2 years, Congress has to run for that office again. It makes them incredibly connected to the communities that elect them. And I can tell you now that there is leadership on both sides of the aisle that is culpable. Reed, Pelosi, McConnell, they're all culpable for the condition we are in right now as a nation, for the condition we are in as a world. I can tell you right now that if we cannot find 435 good men and women to take those seats, we are in really bad shape. In every one of your communities nationwide, I'm sure that you can find one person to go to Washington to represent you, to put the right kind of legislation in place, to make the kinds of changes that need to be made, to hold the agencies accountable for what they have done. The targeting of groups by the IRS, the starving and destruction of small businesses by the EPA, the FDA, the Department of Energy, the Department of Education, department after department, agency after agency, administrations, bureaus, all of them. robbing the American people of trillions of dollars and never doing a thing. The GSA, the General Services Administration, over 25,000 people work in this organization, and they produce nothing. They do nothing but consume your money and deny small businesses the opportunity to sell to the U.S. government. I want you to take stock of yourself as a candidate. Run for office. There's an internet out there. You can do YouTube speeches. You could get yourself known in your small district, and you can run against that guy who has been pulling that same rubber stamp out of his back pocket, stamping laws and bills he never reads, gathering his paycheck, and remaining in Washington disconnected from you. It can be done. All right, let's talk a little bit about the news. Did you know that the Dead Sea was dying? I know, that's why they call it the Dead Sea, right? No, seriously. In Israel, the Dead Sea is actually drying up at an incredible rate, leaving huge chasms of empty space in its wake. These chasms appear in the form of large, devastating sinkholes, just like are happening in Florida, and are increasing in number throughout the region. Experts claim they are now forming at a rate of nearly one a day, but have no way of knowing when or how they will show up. Estimates by Moment magazine suggest that on the Israeli side alone, there are now over 3,000 sinkholes around the Dead Sea. This compares to just 40 counted in 1990, with the first sinkhole appearing in the 1980s. The Dead Sea spans more than 60 miles through Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan. Its waters are 10 times saltier than the North Atlantic Ocean because it has no outlet. This means that any minerals that flow there stay there. The increase in sinkholes is directly related to the Dead Sea drying up at a rate of 1 meter per year. The sinkholes are basically bowl-shaped features that form when an empty space under the ground creates a depression. The depression is the result of a reaction between fresh water and salt buried in a subterranean level beneath the surface. When the fresh water dissolves the salt, it creates a void, causing the landscape around and above it to suddenly collapse. Over the last few decades, increasing numbers of people have been drawn to the Dead Sea, causing its salt water to dry up. This leaves more fresh water in the area to dissolve the salt and create more cavities. This might not be what's happening in Florida. Florida could be because the water table itself is lowering, and these sinkholes are opening all the time. And when they open out in a field somewhere, nobody cares. But when they open inside a town and they swallow up a house and kill somebody, well, then everybody gets excited about it. There are companies in Florida that are making tens of thousands of dollars a day pouring concrete into these sinkholes to prevent literally towns from disappearing. Every time there's a sinkhole, these companies, their phone rings off the hook. And that's what they're after. That's what they're doing. One more quick piece of news. This is in Oregon. Sitting, you know, they sit in a major fault line, right? The Juan de Fuca Plate and the major fault that goes up through that area. It's like Oregon is, it's like 8.5 months pregnant, and it's due any time now for a major earthquake. A geologist with the Oregon Office of Emergency Management told an overflow crowd just a couple days ago in Medford, Oregon. He says, "We're in the zone, and we darn well better get ourselves ready for it." His name is Altheo Rizzo. He's the geology hazard coordinator for OEM. A lot of you may have moved here from California to escape them, but the fact is Oregon is earthquake country. About half the hands went up when Rizzo asked how many had been through a California earthquake. Well, I've been through one. I've been through several. Rizzo said there's a 37% chance the big one will happen in the next 50 years. Well, I guess that means there's an 18% chance that they will occur in the next 25 years. And that's less than the length of a mortgage. A major earthquake would cripple transportation on Interstate 5 as bridges and overpasses collapse from 2 to 4 minutes of ground shaking. Possible, very severe, with stressful aftershocks for weeks. It's going to shake here, she said. Single-family homes will bounce off their foundations. Landslides will cause transportation between I-5 and 101 on the coast to be cut off for 3 to 5 years. A big quake will cause liquefaction, in which the ground, if saturated with water, will turn to pudding, causing hardware such as sewer systems, septic lines, gas tanks to rise up out of the earth. They will float. Lines from Washington State gasoline refineries cross 15 rivers, leaving them vulnerable to quake tremors, she says. Most of these were built in the mid-20th century with no thought to making them quake resistant, she says, adding that they would be offline for at least 6 months. Electrical power would be down from 1 to 3 months until transformers and the electrical grid get going again, she says. Now, in the regional markets, they only have enough food for 3 days, okay? Like your local grocery store, your local Kroger or your Harris Teeter or whatever it is, Piggly Wiggly, Red Owl, only enough food for 3 days. And that's not all food. So, okay, some of it is perishable, like fruits and vegetables. They're replaced every single day. But the supply, canned goods, noodles, dehydrated food, only enough for 3 days. So families should store at least 3 weeks of non-perishable food. Tuna, beans, freeze-dried items, other vital commodities such as toilet paper, toothpaste, you know, shampoo, laundry detergent, those kinds of things. You got to be able to keep your hands clean so the cholera doesn't spread. You have to have a way to deal with your poop, you know. You got to, if the water's cut off, you need to have the ability, several 5-gallon buckets or maybe gather rainwater to be able to flush your toilets manually. Rizzo advocates planning on the household, regional, and statewide levels before the inevitable quake emanates from the big, bad, ugly Cascadia subduction zone, which runs 600 miles from about Eureka, California, to the north end of Vancouver Island. The Northern American tectonic plate on which the Rogue Valley rests is moving southwesterly, a couple of inches a year, overriding oceanic plates and building up tension. When the tension is released, she said, it causes far-reaching land quakes and lifts an enormous amount of seawater, which will slam the Oregon coast with tsunamis. By the way, that will go up the Hood River quite a ways. So if you live along that river, you might want to store some stuff up on the mountain. It causes partial quakes happen on an average of every 240 years. The last one was in 1700, so it's been 213 years, making it about 27 years overdue. Quakes of the entire length of the zone come every 500 to 600 years, and governments should expect those to be about 9.0 or more on the Richter scale. I've been through a 6.5. You can't stand up. It is the most frightening, terrifying situation you can be in. With a fire, you can get out of the house. With a flood, you can get to higher ground. With a quake, the only thing you can do is jump up in the air and stay there. I mean, obviously not possible. Now, these quakes cannot be predicted. Another blow to Oregon would come if vital utilities and transportation were cut off for so long that major businesses left the state and took the jobs and money with them. A dozen years ago, Oregon authorized $2 billion in bonds to bolster infrastructure in schools, community college, and emergency services. But the recession, she said, took that off track. Rizzo urged several hundred local residents to spread the word to family and friends to take first aid and community emergency response team training, store supplies, and get to know your neighbors and people who have training and tools. Communities must assess risks to buildings, roads, power, water, and sewer lines, she said, adding that people should learn to drop, cover, and hold, and practice getting to safe places in their homes. Wall art should be screwed to the wall. Big furniture, water heater, bookcases secured, heavy items kept close to the floor, not up high, where they could fall on people. You need to practice this over and over, because when it's happening, you're not going to be able to do anything. You're going to be wet in your pants. That's what you're going to be doing. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll listen to a little Civil Twilight, and we'll be right back after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming at you.
Yeah. to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Civil twilight, letters from the sky. Those of you that saw the movie I Am Number 4 remember this song from the last of the movie. Really good stuff. By the way, in keeping with the last hour where we were talking about emergency preparedness, I hate to talk about it already because the Halloween stuff is out already, but Christmas is coming up. And the economic condition that most people are in right now, you're already doing some of your Christmas shopping. And that's fine. That's fine. It's all about the spirit of giving. But it's about the spirit of giving them something they can really use, something that will keep them safe. And I would recommend making an investment for those that you love. Not an investment in bonds or stocks or something like that, but in food. And we have one of our favorite affiliates is the Food Investor. If you go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com, the affiliates are listed on the right-hand side. Right at the top is the Food Investor. My favorite buddies, Scott and Danny out there in Utah, have developed a way of making delicious meals with no preservatives and putting them in a package that will preserve them for 25 years. Now, this is really a set-it-and-forget-it kind of food storage program. Once you buy it, you put it into a book bag somewhere in the hall closet toward the front door, and it's your grab bag. It's your get-up-and-go bag. It's your, hey, everything is coming apart. We need to get out of the house fast. Grab this. I would recommend putting together at least a 72-hour kit for every person in your family. But if you're really thinking about a gift for your grandkids or your kids or your grandparents, something that will make them independent of FEMA, having to rely on them for a warm blanket and a cookies and cocoa because, as you know, they haven't been performing too well lately in several of the disasters that we've had in our country, you could take care of yourself. You can have enough food for 3 or 4 days or a week or a month, and you can take care of yourself. And that is something that will make you smart, safe, and protected. But it will also take care of your loved ones. And I highly recommend doing that. So visit the Food Investor today by going to x2-radio.com and picking up a small investment in food. Now, from time to time, people write me about martial law. What is it? How do they do it? What events would cause them to do this? Well, you know, short of a really big disaster like a tsunami or an earthquake or a big set of tornadoes that wipe an area out, you still don't need martial law. We still have organizations, state, city, county, and even federal that can step into place and provide support. In order to put martial law in place, that is to say, when the federal government moves in and becomes the law of the land, the sheriff in town, there must be a strong appearance of organized, regional, and I'm going to call it non-Islamic, resistance to the agency government's rule of laws. There must be an impact for inaction by the agency government, the exposure of a red line that is crossed. By this event is good enough to implement martial law. Are there any non-Islamic activities planned to occur where the press may not be able to avoid covering it? Let's see. Yes, there are. Many Americans are supporting the 18-wheel drivers rolling to D.C. this week by pledging to boycott those 3 days by staying home and avoiding all money transactions for those days. But individuals are not the only ones who have come out in support of this endeavor. A few members with Indiana Overpass for Obama's impeachment are offering to pay for hotel rooms and a meal for 2 of the truckers. A truck stop in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is offering 50 gallons of free fuel to the first 20 truckers that come by their establishment with pictures showing their rig in D.C. during those 3 days. In other words, there's a national grassroots support for this. There has even been a post from a man in Germany, written in German, supporting the Million Trucker March to D.C. Truck drivers, are posting pictures of themselves with their trucks and indicating whether they will shut down and stay home or shut down for the drive to D.C. A reprint of the Freedom Outpost article appearing on the Daily Paul. The Blaze posted an article the day after Freedom Outpost, and Fox News picked up that article and scrolled the information in their news ticker. So it is getting out there, my friends. Bikers from across America roared into Washington September 11th to get the attention of the White House and Congress with the message they're really not fans of the Change America themes pursued of late. Organized through a loose coalition of Facebook pages and a contingent of volunteers who each took care of their own state, it resulted in official estimates of about 1 million motorcycles descending on Washington. The bikers carried the message that they oppose Obama's push to fundamentally transform the U.S. Radio giant Rush Limbaugh said the American public as a whole did not understand what Obama was intending to do when he campaigned in 2008 with that remark. They had no idea that fundamentally transforming the United States of America meant turning the Constitution of the United States on its head, Limbaugh said. They had no idea that transforming the United States of America meant getting rid of capitalism and replacing it with socialism. They had no idea that it meant co-opting 1/6 of the U.S. economy by the government, the healthcare business. They had no idea what Obama was promising. They thought they knew, but they didn't. Some of them may now not even know, but the bikers in D.C. know and knew. Now the big rigs want Washington's attention too, and they'll be coming in 18 wheels at a time instead of two. Once again, the plans are appearing on a number of Facebook pages where truckers say they are fed up with the changes in America and the administration's failure to address adequately a number of economic issues that hit consumers hard, and they want something done. One page calls truckers to shut down America, calls for a 3-day general strike by truckers, October 11th. Through the 13th. It declares, the American people are sick and tired of the corruption that is destroying America. Truckers are pledging not to haul freight on those days and say consumers can join in with truck drivers by staying home and not making any purchases. Another page called 1 Million Trucks to D.C. pledges to get as many truck drivers to converge on Washington, D.C. on October 11th as possible. The primary focus of the protest will be the price of fuel, since Barack Obama has occupied the Oval Office. Statistics show the average price of unleaded gasoline in the U.S. was $1.84 on January 19, 2009, the day before Obama took office. A recent survey found that figure was at $3.61 per gallon, up more than 90%. And that wasn't even the highest price for fuel under Obama. In 2011, it reached just a few pennies short of $4 a gallon. And by the way, if you're a trucker, you don't use gasoline. You use diesel. And it's been at $4 a gallon for years. According to a blog that was promoting the strike and rally in Washington, shiftplan.com, the grassroots action is intended to bring into discussion issues of significance. And I quote, Last year, the American Truckers Association prepared a report for Congress highlighting the susceptibility of the nation's just-in-time delivery system, the majority of which is made possible by the transport and delivery of freight. In the event of a catastrophic disaster, such as a war that drives fuel prices through the roof, or even a natural disaster such as a solar flare that renders electronic trucks inoperable, there would be a swift and devastating impact on the food, healthcare, transportation, waste removal, retail, manufacturing, and the financial sectors. The backbone of commerce in the United States are the truck drivers, who spend long hours on the road ensuring our very survival as a modern society, the report said. But with fuel prices continuing to rise, wages dropping, jobs becoming harder to find, and rampant corruption in Washington, D.C., furthering the country's economic death spiral, America's truck drivers, like the majority of our fellow citizens, are fed up. The strike, the report said, will be coordinated with an invasion of Washington. The protest calls for truckers to make their way to Washington, D.C. in a massive convoy in an effort to call attention to, among other things, the Benghazi cover-up, the recent attack which killed 25 members of SEAL Team 6, ever-rising fuel prices, and claims that President Obama has engaged in treasonous crimes. One advocate wrote, "The American people are bleeding out with no relief in sight. It is time to change the news. Let us show our elected officials that we are 100% fed up with corruption and the blatant disregard of the Constitution that they swore to defend. It does not matter if a million or 50 roll through D.C. in that effort. Congress will listen to we the people," which is remove Obama from office for crimes of treason and misdemeanors. We want congressional hearings on Benghazi and SEAL Team 6. There's a blog author, his name is Max Slavo, and he noted, "The corruption and need for real change in America's government has transcended political lines. If the hundreds of thousands of truckers across America who keep our delivery systems running efficiently were to join together and stop hauling freight, even for a week, the impact would be devastating and could not be ignored. There'd be no food on the shelves, no fuel at our gas stations, and no medical supplies at our pharmacies and hospitals. Congress and the president, who would like nothing more than to be perceived as our saviors and benefactors, would have no choice but to address the concerns of freight haulers, because the American people would feel the effects of the protest directly. And chances are they'd be in the streets protesting themselves because of the lack of access to essential goods that they can't live without. The question is, would they be protesting the truckers or would they be protesting the politicians? Would the press blame the truckers or would the press blame the politicians? I think you already know the answer to that. We have seen it already happen in Egypt, where the people rose up and threw the Muslim Brotherhood out. The press defended the Muslim Brotherhood and called the people rebels. Well, there have been tens of thousands already who have signed on in favor of the plans on the Facebook pages. Wrote one ready-to-go trucker, "We are the people. It's our government. It's our choice to run it." Another said he could not travel to Washington, but was making plans to hunker down and phone bomb D.C. Another commenter, James Bricken, said, "The silent majority is getting fed up and starting to speak up. This isn't just about truckers. It's about all Americans." Others confirmed their participation with the truck stop, promised 50 gallons of fuel. Well, I already told you that about the 50 gallons of fuel for the first truckers that could show a picture of themselves in Washington. At Freedom Outpost, it was estimated there were 150,000 independent owner trucker owner truck drivers across the country enough to make a big statement in Washington. I think there are more than that. Adding patriotic company drivers would increase the message by halting the transport of goods throughout the country and ceasing all money transactions and shopping for 3 days. It would signal a nationwide peaceful protest against the tyranny in Washington. And that is exactly right, fellow Earth explorers. It is tyranny, nothing more, nothing less. The agency government that uses its regulations to tax you, to enforce itself against you, to confiscate your property, to forbid you from conducting your business, and you have no representation in that government. You can say nothing and do nothing about it. That is the definition of tyranny. The request also went out to start publicizing the events via citizens' band radios, as some drivers are without routine access to the internet. Lots of interesting stuff here. So, let's see here. Let me just translate. Okay. Is this enough to call for an enforcement action by the Transportation Safety Administration or the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Transportation? Need I name a few more agencies, departments, or administrations? If the people are calling for the de facto impeachment of Obama, will Congress listen? If Congress does not listen, what will the apathetic American voter, languishing on government handouts and free cell phones, do to revitalize the Republic with candidates who will do the will of the people? Or will the people continue to vote for free handouts and cell phones? By the way, I saw a local newspaper in Charlotte yesterday. That would be the 21st of September. The headline read, North Carolina has become ground zero for voter discrimination. The article was pointed directly at the state's recent decision to ask for photo ID before allowing a person to vote. Please help me understand why asking for a simple photo ID will discriminate against any citizen from voting. Oh yeah, I almost forgot. Obama did not win a single state that requires photo ID to vote. Coincidence? Perhaps. All right, so would martial law happen or not? I would say that if you try to shut down Washington, D.C., it's going to be a little bit like the air traffic controllers in Reagan's day. They will consider the movement of freight and the operation of 80,000-pound rigs on the highways to be a national necessity, and that shutting off that national necessity would jeopardize the security and safety of the public. And so, therefore, the federal government would move in, take the license numbers of every single truck that was involved in that, and they would go after each and every one of those drivers and put them in jail. That's what I think. That's martial law. Well, look at it this way. It would create 150,000 or more instant jobs. We'd need more truck drivers. But wait a minute. We already need more truck drivers. There's already a shortage of truck drivers out there. Well, maybe that plan's not too smart after all. We'll just have to wait and see what happens on October 11th. We'll be covering it right here at X Squared Radio. All right, some of you wrote me and asked me for a Fukushima update. The crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant has radiation leaks strong enough to deliver a fatal dose. Not within years. Nope. Not within weeks. Within hours. Japanese authorities have revealed, as the government prepares to step in to help contain leaks of highly toxic water at the site, that if you get too close to this site without proper clothing and protection, you'll be dead before noon. On Wednesday, the country's Nuclear Regulation Authority said radiation readings near water storage tanks at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant have increased to a new high. They're not going down. They're going up. With emissions above the ground near one group of tanks were as high as 2,200 millisieverts per hour, a rise of 20% from the previous high. Earlier this week, the plant's operator, TEPCO, said workers had measured radiation at 1,800 millisieverts an hour near a storage tank. So what's causing the increased radiation? Well, can you say criticality? That was the previous highest reading since TEPCO began installing tanks to store huge quantities of contaminated water that have built up near the plant. An unprotected person standing close to the contaminated area would, within hours, receive a deadly radiation dose. The Nuclear Regulation Authority said the radiation comprised mostly beta rays that could be blocked by aluminum foil, unlike more penetrative gamma rays. Beta rays, a beta decay is actually a particle decay. It is a lower frequency, doesn't have a whole lot of energy. But if you're just wearing a simple aluminum suit, it can be blocked. It can also be blocked by ordinary windshield glass or the metal of an automobile. Gamma rays won't go through; will go right through that to you. But beta rays are much lower. However, a beta decay striking the human body will activate molecules in the human body, and the decay within a few hours would kill healthy tissue and you'd probably end up hemorrhaging to death. TEPCO's admission in August that about 300 tons of radioactive groundwater is escaping into the nearby Pacific Ocean every day. And I don't know if you know anything about water treatment or waste treatment or any of that, but there is a common slogan, and the slogan is, "The solution is dilution." Yes, that's right. So you dump the 300 tons of radioactive groundwater into the Pacific Ocean, and you simply dilute it into the Pacific Ocean. The problem is that the oceanic currents do not disperse this, but keep it in a concentrated river that flows right toward the Pacific Northwest, as if they didn't already have enough problems with the Pacific subduction. The emergency measures announced on Tuesday of this last week involved building a mile-long impenetrable frozen wall between the plant or beneath the plant to prevent groundwater from mixing with contaminated coolant water. The coolant becomes tainted after coming in contact with melted uranium fuel deep inside the damaged reactors. Currently, about 400 tons of groundwater are streaming into the reactor basements from the hills behind the plant each day. The water is pumped out, obviously, and held in about 1,000 storage tanks. The tanks contain 330,000 tons of water with varying levels of toxicity. Officials are conducting a feasibility study into the frozen wall, with completion expected by March of 2015. Although the technology isn't new, the scale of the Fukushima Daiichi project is unprecedented for an atomic facility. The government also wants to speed up the development of a new water treatment plant system that can remove most of the radioactive substances from the water. TEPCO has already constructed one such facility, but it has not been used since equipment was found to have corroded during a trial run. The Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, said he understood the growing concern at home and overseas about the state of the plant, but said his government was now taking the lead to solve the problem. To do that, we are resolutely implementing drastic measures. Abe, who will make Tokyo's final pitch in the city's bid to host the 2020 Olympics at a meeting of the International Olympic Committee in Buenos Aires this weekend, added, "I will be explaining to the IOC that in 7 years' time, 2020 It will not be a problem at all. We are now within 2 months of what may be humankind's most dangerous moment since the Cuban Missile Crisis. There is no excuse for not acting. All the resources our species can muster must be focused on the fuel pool at Fukushima Unit 4. Fukushima's owner, Tokyo Electric, that's TEPCO, says that within as few as 60 days, it may begin trying to remove more than 1,300 spent fuel rods from a badly damaged pool perched 100 feet in the air. The pool rests on a badly damaged building that is tilting, sinking, and could easily come down in the next earthquake if not on its own. Some 400 tons of fuel in that pool could spew out more than 15,000 times as much radiation as was released at Hiroshima. The one thing certain about this crisis is that TEPCO does not have the scientific, engineering, or financial resources to handle it, nor does the Japanese government. The situation demands a coordinated global effort of the best scientists and engineers our species can muster. Many ask, why is this so serious? We already know that thousands of tons of heavily contaminated water are pouring through the Fukushima site, carrying a devil's brew of long-lived poisonous isotopes into the Pacific. Tuna, irradiated with fallout traceable to Fukushima, have already been caught off the coast of California, and we definitely can expect worse, much worse. TEPCO continues to pour more water onto the proximate site of three melted reactor cores it must somehow keep cool. Steam plumes indicate fission may still be going on somewhere underground, but no one knows exactly where those cores actually are. Much of that irradiated water now sits in roughly 1,000 huge but fragile tanks that have been quickly assembled and strewn around the site. The water flowing through the site is also undermining the remnant structures at Fukushima, including the one supporting the fuel pool at Unit 4. So, it is not a good story. It is not a good solution. There are not enough resources being poured into it. And the radiation that it's pouring into the Pacific Ocean is cumulative. It continues to build in the animal life of the ocean. And as each generation of those animals grows and feeds off one another, it becomes more and more concentrated, which means it becomes more and more toxic to humans who might consume it. So I would beware if you're buying tuna in a can that comes from the Pacific. I would beware if you're buying wine that comes from the Pacific, if it comes after a certain date. You might consider buying Chilean wines. So a lot of people remember the name Chernobyl. The first 1986 fallout reached California within 10 days. Fukushima's in 2011 arrived in less than a week. A new fuel fire at Unit 4 would pour out a continuous stream of lethal radioactive poisons, literally for centuries. Many people think we have 2 months or less to act. They are petitioning the United Nations and President Obama to mobilize the global scientific and engineering community to take charge at Fukushima and the job of moving these fuel rods to safety. There is a petition out there that you can sign. I may put the link at X Squared Radio. Not really sure a petition will do much good. But along the same lines, there was a story that came out this week, and it's a history story, which we love here at X Squared Radio. I'm titling it The Day North Carolina Nearly Died. A secret document published in declassified form for the first time by The Guardian today reveals that the U.S. Air Force came dramatically close to detonating an atom bomb over North Carolina that would have been 260 times more powerful than the device that devastated Hiroshima. The document, obtained by the investigative journalist Eric Schlosser under the Freedom of Information Act, gives the first conclusive evidence that the U.S. was narrowly spared a disaster of monumental proportions when two Mark 39 hydrogen bombs were accidentally dropped over Goldsboro, North Carolina, on the 23rd of January, 1961. The bombs fell to Earth after a B-52 bomber broke up in midair, and one of the devices behaved precisely as a nuclear weapon was designed to behave in warfare. Its parachute opened, its trigger mechanisms engaged, and only one low-voltage switch prevented untold carnage. Each bomb carried a payload of 4 megatons, the equivalent of 4 million tons of TNT explosive. Had that device detonated, lethal fallout could have been deposited over Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and as far north as New York City, putting tens of millions of lives at risk. Though there has been persistent speculation on how narrow the Goldsboro escape was, the U.S. government has repeatedly, publicly denied that its nuclear arsenal has ever put Americans' lives in jeopardy through safety flaws. But in the newly published document, a senior engineer in the Sandia National Laboratories, responsible for the mechanical safety of nuclear weapons, concludes that one simple dynamo technology, low voltage switch, stood between the United States and a major catastrophe. Writing 8 years after the accident, Parker F. Jones found that the bombs that dropped over North Carolina just 3 days after John F. Kennedy made his inaugural address as a president were inadequate in their safety controls, and that the final switch that prevented disaster could easily have been shorted by an electrical jolt leading to a nuclear burst. It would have been bad news in spades, he wrote. Jones dryly entitled his secret report, Goldsboro Revisited, or How I Learned to Mistrust the H-Bomb. That's a quip on Stanley Kubrick's 1964 satirical film about a nuclear holocaust called Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. If you haven't seen that movie, you need to see it. It has Slim Pickens in it. He's in a scene where the bomb will not, you know, drop from the plane. And so he actually rides it like a bucking bronc and makes it let loose from the plane and rides it all the way to the ground while it explodes. Yeah, it's really quite the movie. The accident happened when a B-52 bomber got into trouble, having embarked from Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro for a routine flight across the East Coast. As it went into a tailspin, the hydrogen bomb it was carrying became separated. One fell into a field near Faro, North Carolina, its parachute draped in the branches of a tree, and the other plummeted into a meadow off Big Daddy's Road. Jones found that of the 4 safety mechanisms in the Faro bomb designed to prevent unintended detonation, 3 failed to operate properly. When the bomb hit the ground, the firing signal was sent to the nuclear core of the device, and it was only that final, highly vulnerable switch that averted calamity. The MK-39 Mod 2 bomb did not possess adequate safety for the airborne alert role in the B-52, Jones concludes. Scary stuff. The document was uncovered by Schlosser as part of his research into his new book on the nuclear arms race called Command and Control. Using Freedom of Information, he discovered that at least 700 significant accidents and incidents involving 1,250 nuclear weapons were recorded between 1950 and 1968 alone. The U.S. government has consistently tried to withhold information from the American people in order to prevent questions being asked about our nuclear weapons policy, he said. We were told there was no possibilities of these weapons accidentally detonating. Yet here's one that very nearly did. Wow. In the final piece tonight, we'll continue on our theme on martial law, what would it take? This is the rhetoric that we're hearing in the press today. And we're not just hearing it in the press, we're also hearing it from our own elected officials. Excuse me while I take a sip. We all want to know who the enemy really is. And we have concluded, based on the actions of several private businesses, some YouTubes that I have recently seen about people that have the right to and license to carry a weapon being stopped, searched, frisked, delayed, examined by local police for carrying their weapons into a store where there was no sign on the door that said no weapons allowed. The fact is that the armed American is an enemy of the state. Last week, Starbucks asked its American customers to please not bring their guns into the coffee shop. Folks, I'm reading this one sentence and I'm saying, Starbucks, you're asking for it. Do you realize that law-abiding citizens wearing a gun in your coffee shop virtually 110% guarantees that no one will ever get shot in a Starbucks coffee shop? The fact that you have just made your coffee shops a gun-free zone nationally targets every single customer that goes into your store because there's no one there to protect them. Next sentence. This is part of the company's concern about customer safety and follows a ban in the summer on smoking within 25 feet of a coffee shop entrance and an earlier ruling about scalding hot coffee. After the celebrated Liebig versus McDonald's case in 1994 involving a woman who suffered third-degree burns to her thighs, Starbucks complies with the Specialty Coffee Association of America's recommendation that drinks should be served at a maximum temperature of 82 degrees C. Not quite enough to cause a scald, but just a couple degrees over the temperature at which coffee begins to taste like dishwater. Although it was brave of Howard Schultz, the company's chief executive, to go even this far in a country where people are better armed and only slightly less nervy than rebel fighters in Syria, we should note that dealing with the risks of scalding and secondary smoke came well before addressing the problem of people who go armed to buy a latte. There can be no weirder order of priorities on this planet, I am sure. That's America, we say, as news of the latest massacre breaks. Last week, it was the slaughter of 12 people by Aaron Alexis at Washington, D.C.'s Naval Yard, where, unfortunately, nobody was armed. But what if we no longer thought of this as just a problem for America, and instead we viewed it as an international humanitarian crisis, a quasi-civil war, if you like, that calls for outside intervention. As citizens of the world, perhaps we should demand an end to the unimaginable suffering of victims and their families, the maiming and killing of children, just as America does in every new civil conflict around the globe. The annual toll from firearms in the U.S. is running at 32 1,000 deaths a year and climbing, even though the general crime rate is on a downward path. By the way, it's 40% lower than it was in 1980. If this perennial slaughter doesn't qualify for intercession by the UN and all relevant NGOs, it's hard to know what does. To absorb the scale of the mayhem, it's worth trying to guess the death toll of all the wars in American history since the War of Independence began in 1775, and follow that by estimating the number killed by firearms in the U.S. since the day Robert F. Kennedy was shot in 1968 by a .22 Ivers Johnson handgun wielded by Sirhan Sirhan. The figures from Congressional Research Service plus recent statistics from iCasualties.org tell us that from the first casualties in the Battle of Lexington to recent operations in Afghanistan, the toll is 1,171,177. Those are all of the deaths from firearms in this country. That's it. 1,171,177 since 1775. By contrast, the number killed by firearms, including suicides, since 1968, significantly later than 1775, we're only talking about 45 years. 45 years, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the FBI, is 1,384,171 people. That's more. That 212,994 more Americans lost their lives from firearms in the last 45 years than in all wars involving the U.S. is a staggering fact, particularly when you place it in the context of the safety-conscious secondary smoke obsessions that characterize so much of American life. And let's not forget refined sugar. Oh, my gosh. Now, there's a killer. Everywhere you look in America, people are trying to make life safer. On roads, for example, there's been a huge effort in the last 50 years to enforce speed limits, crack down on drinking and driving and drugs, and building safety features into highways as well as the vehicles. The result is a steadily improving record. By 2015, forecasters predict that for the first time, road deaths will be fewer than those caused by firearms. Plainly, there's no equivalent effort in the area of privately owned firearms. Indeed, most politicians do everything they can to make the country less safe. Recently, a Democrat senator from Arkansas named Mark Pryor ran a TV ad against the gun control campaign funded by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, one of the few politicians to stand up to the NRA lobby, explaining why he was against enhanced background checks on gun owners, yet was committed to finding real solutions to violence. About their own safety, Americans often have an unusual ability to hold two utterly opposed ideas in their head simultaneously. That can only explain the past decade in which the fear of terror has cost the country hundreds of billions of dollars in wars, surveillance, and intelligence programs, and Homeland Security. 10 years after 9/11, Homeland Security spending doubled to $69 billion. The total bill since the attacks is more than $649 billion. One more figure. There have been fewer than 20 terror-related deaths on American soil since 9/11 and about 364,000 deaths caused by privately owned firearms. If any European nation had such a record and persisted in addressing only the first figure while ignoring the second, you can bet your last pound that the State Department would be warning against travel to that country and no American would set foot in it without body armor. But no nation sees itself as outsiders do. Half the country is sane and rational, while the other half is simply doesn't grasp the inconsistencies and historic lunacy of its position, which springs from the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms and is derived from English common law and our 1689 Bill of Rights. We dispensed with these rights a long time ago, but American gun owners cleave to them with the tenacity that previous generations fought to continue slavery. Astonishingly, when owning a gun is not about ludicrous macho fantasy, it is mostly seen as a matter of personal safety, like the airbag in the new Ford pickup or avoiding secondary smoke, despite conclusive evidence that people become less safe as gun ownership rises. I highly question that statistic. Last week, this writer happened to be in New York for 9/11 anniversary. It occurred to him now that the city that suffered most dreadfully in the attacks and has the greatest reason for jumpiness is also among the places where you find most sense on the gun issue in America. New Yorkers understand that fear breeds peril, and regardless of tragedies such as Sandy Hook and the D.C. Naval Yard, the NRA, the gun manufacturers, conservative inclined politicians, and parts of the media will continue to advocate a right which, at base, is as archaic as a witch trial. While the press would have you believe it is an armed American that is the enemy to the state, the reality is that it is an unarmed American that is the victim of those who would take something that does not belong to them. These thugs and seemingly programmed assassins are only empowered by gun restrictions. No one ever was raped who was armed with a .38. No thief would brave robbing a home where he knew the owners were armed and trained to use their weapon. No force has ever succeeded in defeating an armed populace. Perhaps armed Americans are the enemy of the state. Perhaps the state should consider the risks of what they are doing if they are on the wrong side of law-abiding citizens who are armed and willing to really defend the Constitution of the United States. Would American soldiers march against American citizens to defeat them in armed insurrection? 90% of sheriffs say no. 90% of police say yes. The National Guard says no. The professional army says yes. The Democrats say kill them all. The Republicans say, stand your ground. Are we squaring off for a civil war? Over what? The right of government to rule over us? You decide. No more delays. You got 1 year. You got 1 year to go to the polls and replace the Congress. All right, final story. Increasingly, science agrees with the poetry of direct human experience. We are more than the atoms and molecules that make up our bodies, but beings of light as well. Biophotons are emitted by the human body and can be released through mental intention and may modulate fundamental processes within cell-to-cell communication and DNA. Nothing is more amazing than the highly improbable fact that we actually exist. Now, we often ignore this fact, oblivious to the reality that instead of something, there could be nothing at all. For example, why is there a universe and not some void completely unconscious of itself? Consider that from light, air, water, basic minerals within the crust of the earth, and the at least 3 billion-year-old information contained within the nucleus of one diploid zygote cell. The human body is formed, and within that body a soul capable of at least trying to comprehend its bodily and spiritual origins. Given the sheer insanity of our existential condition, and bodily incarnation as a whole, and considering that our earthly existence is partially formed from sunlight and requires the continual consumption of condensed sunlight in the form of food, It may not sound so far-fetched that our body emits light. Well, most bodies emit light. Some of them are dark as can be. But indeed, the human body emits biophotons, also known as ultra-weak photon emissions, UPEs, with a visibility 1,000 times lower than the sensitivity of our naked eye. Now, while not visible to us, these particles of light are part of the visible electromagnetic spectrum between 380 and 780 nanometers, and they are detectable via sophisticated modern instrumentation. The eye itself, which is continually exposed to ambient powerful photons that pass through various ocular tissues, rods and cones, emits spontaneous and visible light-induced ultra-weak photon emissions. It has even been hypothesized that visible light induces delayed bioluminescence within the exposed eye tissue, providing an explanation for the origin of the negative afterimage. These light emissions have also been correlated with cerebral energy metabolism and oxidative stress within the mammalian brain. That's us. We're mammals. And yet biophoton emissions are not necessarily epiphenomenal. Bocan's hypothesis suggests that photons released from chemical processes within the brain produced biophysical pictures during visual imagery. And a recent study found that when subjects actively imagined light in a very dark environment, their intention produced significant increases in ultra-weak photo emissions. This is consistent with an emerging view that biophotons are not solely cellular metabolic byproducts, but rather, because biophoton intensity can be considerably higher inside cells than outside, it is possible for the mind to access this energy gradient to create intrinsic biophysical pictures during the visual perception and imagery. And that's powerful, because that means that with our intention, with our concentration and our own minds, we can create light with our own bodies, which means if we create this higher vibrational existence that many talk about, this feeling of peace and love, this reaching out to one another with benevolence and mercy, we actually do put off light. Apparently, biophotons are used by the cells of many living organisms to communicate, which facilitates energy information transfer that is several orders of magnitude faster than chemical diffusion. When you touch something, you create an impulse on a nerve which can travel chemically from one ion to the other up that nerve to the brain. We already know how long that takes, upwards of half a second for the sensation to actually reach the brain. For the brain to actually decide what to do about it, and then about a quarter to half a second to get that information back to the muscle to move the hand or to make a step or to dodge out of the way or catch a ball. Light communication between cells is many orders of magnitude faster. Cell-to-cell communication by biophotons has been demonstrated in plants, bacteria, animal neutrophili, or neutrophils, granulocytes, and kidney cells. Researchers were able to demonstrate that different spectral light stimulation, infrared, yellow, blue, green, and white at one end of the spinal sensory of a motor nerve root resulted in a significant increase in the biophotonic activity at the other end. Researchers interpreted their findings to suggest that light stimulation can generate biophotons that conduct along the neural fibers, probably as neural communication signals, which means the average person at least is somewhat solar powered, or at least solar activated. Technically speaking, A biophoton is an elementary particle of quantum or quantum of light of non-thermal origin in the visible and ultraviolet spectrum emitted from a biological system. So the interesting thing is that because the metabolism of the body changes in a circadian fashion, biophoton emissions also variate along the axis of diurnal time. Research has mapped out distinct anatomical locations within the body where biophoton emissions are stronger and weaker depending on the time of day. Generally, the fluctuation in photon counts over the whole body was lower in the morning than in the afternoon. The thorax abdomen region emitted the lowest, most constantly. The upper extremities of the head emitted the most and increasingly over the day. Spectral analysis of the low, intermediate, and high emissions from the superior frontal part of the right leg, the forehead, and the palms in the sensitivity range of the photomultiplier. A photomultiplier is a tube that is sensitive to photons coming into it. Obviously, these cannot be measured in one onesies, twosies. And so what happens is a single or four or half a dozen photons come in, and the photomultiplier tube will reflect or increase the numbers, a lot like ping pong balls on a bunch of mousetraps in a room, a kind of chain reaction. But it's directly proportional to the amount of photons that come in. When you get that many photons, then they're detectable, and they actually show up either on a screen or a meter of some kind, and it is proportional to the amount of photons that actually hit it. That's why we use photomultiplier tubes. Most of the spontaneous emissions were between 470 and 570 nanometers. This is kind of in the green range. The central palm area of the hand emission showed a larger contribution of the 420 to 470 nanometer range. The spectrum of delayed luminescence from the hand showed major emissions in the same range as spontaneous emission. This generally means that almost visible, certain individuals who can concentrate and direct this energy can emit light from their hands or from their forehead. Some individuals may be more adept at doing this than others, but the fact is that it can be measured. Interestingly, an herb well known for its use in stress reduction, including inducing measurable declines in cortisol and associated heightened oxidative stress, has been tested clinically in reducing the level of biophotons emitted in human subjects. So you want to avoid that herb. It's known as rhodiola. A study published in 2009 in the journal Phytotherapeutic Research found that those who took the herb for 1 week had a significant decrease in photon emission in comparison with the placebo group. Well, I, for one, would like to put off as much light as possible. But the most extraordinary finding of all is the possibility that our bodily surface, which is our skin, actually is capable of trapping the energy information from ultraviolet radiation. So we are completely out of time. Fascinating subject. If you want the show notes from tonight, you can write me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, and I will be happy to send them to you. Thank you so much for being part of the program, and we'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, saying peace, Earth Explorers.